pretty funny, where it's like, you know, Freddie Blassie's like, "Oh, hello, you pencil neck geeks." We get somebody on the internet that sounds like a old wrestling manager.
Did you watch that video?
I have not watched that video. I'm going to be just completely honest with you. Of your friend that's the friend that impersonates Stone Cold?
Yeah, I figured you didn't. I think I have it on here. Let me see if I can find it. If I can figure out how to use this.
And in the meantime, everybody, my name's Luke Bad News Burton. And of course, as I'm doing this intro, there's somebody backing up a truck outside of my apartment.
What the fuck?
What is happening? Oh, my goodness.
I'm Psycho Steve Fury.
And this is Wrestleology. We give context to today's present moment in professional wrestling by taking a look at the past. And this episode, everybody, we are diving in from our introduction into the start of professional wrestling all the way into the territories, which would be considered the NWA, and all the way up until 1994 in a bingo hall in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania for a small promotion called Eastern Championship Wrestling. But we will get to that eventually. But we, I know that we are starting off with you, but before that, do you want to play this video of your friend doing Stone Cold Steve Austin?
Yeah. I hope it's loud enough. Let me just go ahead and turn this up. Oh, that's going to be real loud. You're probably going to hear it. Oh, well. And
just hit play. I said he's talking shit. I can smell it from here. What? It smells like shit.
What?
That makes me want to puke.
What?
I said it makes me want to vomit.
What?
I said it makes me want to regurgitate.
There's more, but a lot of it was lost.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, it's real good.
Oh, my gosh. He just sounds like he's yelling. Just yelling bionic redneck idioms.
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, especially with all the like documentaries that A&E is coming out with.
Yeah, I haven't watched any of them yet.
Oh, my gosh, man. Like, I haven't watched... the only thing that I really watched so far is The Dark Side of the Ring. The one with Brian Pillman?
The one I sent you? I don't even think that's the actual episode.
It is the actual episode.
That's because the one on IMDb is called, I want to say it's History of Brian Pillman.
I'm telling you, dude, it's 45 minutes long.
Yeah, it's on I know. I'm thinking it might be like a pre-episode to the episode.
How long are those episodes?
They're usually about an hour long.
Dude, that's the actual episode because with commercial breaks, 45 minutes is a full commercial, is a full TV hour.
But like I was saying, it's called, I think that's called Brian Pillman Breaking the Fourth Wall of Wrestling.
Yeah.
The first episode of season 3 is actually called The Career and Death of Brian Pillman.
It does end a little bit abrupt. There might be stuff, and it might be going on. It might go on longer.
Well, it's a two-part episode.
Oh, it's a two-part episode. So I think the first part must have aired, and that must have been the stuff that you sent me over because
the first part actually doesn't air until May 6th.
What?
Yeah,
so
that's
the second part of the
episode. I'm thinking it's like a teaser to the whole season, like, hey, here's a bonus episode kind of thing. I mean, that'd be awesome.
I mean, that's cool. Did you watch it at all?
I did. It's really, really good.
It gives an insight in like how crazy of a business professional wrestling actually is. You know, like the fact that Brian Pillman was literally driving himself actually crazy. The fact that he had like three wives, children with each of them, and that he's like just going from town to town, like convincing different promotions to release him or sign him. And manipulating the old school like kayfabe and like the backstage politics so that he could essentially break the fourth wall and expose the business for people that were on the outside that were looking in, and that people that actually knew the vernacular like you and I or different wrestling fans like felt like they were actually getting a little sneak peek behind the curtain, which I thought was kind of genius. It was ahead of its time, 100% ahead of its time, but it's I mean, it's definitely something that you'd need to watch if you're really looking to get into professional wrestling, and to also explain a little bit more about what the landscape of current professional wrestling is.
So this season three, I only know of three episodes for the first part of the season. It's Brian Pillman's going to be episode one. Mm-hmm. They're doing a part two of Brian Pillman for episode two. And then episode three is what I'm probably the most excited about.
Is it Nick fucking Cage?
It is. Oh, Nick Gage, yeah. Oh, my
gosh. The king of the deathmatch wrestling, man.
Apparently, he went to prison for armed robbery. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. He almost died. He cut open an artery during a Cage of Death match or a tournament of death match. I forget what it was for CZW, but he went through one of those like light tube, like it was like a bound table of light tubes, or like it was a bound thing of light tubes between two chairs. He went through it legs first and it cut his carotid artery in his like leg, and he started bleeding out. And if they didn't have paramedics right there, he would have bled out to his death. That dude is no joke, man. Like, he's probably the toughest guy in professional wrestling, bar none.
He almost killed David Arquette also.
Yeah, I mean, that's the teaser to it, is that he was in over his head.
Dude.
You saw the where he smashed the group of light tubes over his head, right?
Yeah, and then he had old Luke Perry and Jungle Boy rush him to the hospital.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's in it's on Hulu.
Oh, it's
the documentary about David Arquette.
Yeah, the one that you were telling me about, right?
Yeah, it's like Can't Kill David Arquette or something like that.
David Arquette Can't Die or something like that.
Yeah.
Whatever.
It's pretty good. You kind of feel bad for him, and then you realize that he's kind of a terrible human. I'm sorry, David Arquette, if you're listening.
I mean, you chose it, so it's your fault anyways. Anyways.
Shouldn't have taken that WCW championship.
I mean, but you would have done it too.
You right.
Yeah, I would have done it.
Yeah,
you would have done it. Yeah, if someone put me in the same position as like Nicholas at WrestleMania, was like, hey, dude, you're going to ruin wrestling for like the next 10 years for tag teams in WWE, but you're going to be...
Everybody's going to hate you.
Yeah, everyone's going to hate you, but you're going to be like the coolest kid in school for the next 10 years. Would you do it? Totally. I'd do it every day of the week.
So another thing I wanted to bring up, before we dive into the origin of professional wrestling.
Right at it.
Did you see who came back to WWE last night? I'm sure you know. You
have Eva Marie?
Yeah, Eva Marie. They just won't give up on her.
I mean, she's pretty.
That's all.
Hey, you remember that time that you wanted me to cut something out of this episode and then we're re-recording it?
Yeah, but I'm not... I'm talking about how terrible Eva Marie is.
So for context, everybody, we were recording this episode before, and because it was our first time doing one of these episodes where we're like chronologically going through the history of professional wrestling, me and Steve didn't really prepare ourselves well to record that podcast and had done the research the night before. And it ended up okay. I listened it back, but we had said something in the part of it. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because I think that this is a really good like topic to jump off for just the rest of our podcast.
Yeah.
Is that we both aren't politically correct and we both have a similar vision to what this podcast want to be. And we have different experiences with professional wrestling, which are not sexist, by the way. They just are a part of the way that we grew up and the way that we've been conditioned for professional wrestling. And it came up about professional wrestling, specifically women's professional wrestling, about how it used to be so bad back in the Attitude Era, where women were essentially seen as props, similar to championships, right? To where women's wrestling would go on for maybe like 5 to 10 minutes at most. And if it was a longer match, it was usually like a lingerie-filled or a bra and panties match. And it was more so like an expose than actually wrestling. And most of the time when people
just
see women...
objectifying those poor women.
Huh. Right. And because of that, and because me and Steve, I would consider you a wrestling purist, that you like to watch wrestling because of the storytelling, the actual art, and the violence in it. People like Steve and I would make a joke that, you know, oh, the women's wrestling's on. It's time for us to go to do a bathroom break.
It could have came off like we were sexist or misogynistic, when that's not the case at all.
No, it's just if you ever hear something like that during these podcasts, and I know that this is something that's not in contention because we edited, we weren't even going to edit it out, or we were going to edit it out. We just decided to re-record the podcast. And I thought that it was a really good topic to bring up because I think that when it comes to our views on professional wrestling, keep in mind that wrestling, as well as the world within the past 20 years, has changed a lot in terms of political correctness. And a lot of things have changed for the better, such as women's professional wrestling has become better, like legitimately become better.
You can, 100% better.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Becky Lynch was the main draw of WrestleMania and faced Ronda Rousey and Charlotte Flair legitimately in a main event that was probably the best build-up on that show is legit, and we're not taking anything away from it. Whenever we come from a place of experience, it comes from a place of us seeing what has happened prior in professional wrestling, and if we give context to that thing, even though it might not feel 100% great, and it might seem as we're coming from an angle of discrimination or coming from an angle of putting somebody else down, just keep in mind that we've been watching and we've been doing a lot of research, and we see that there are patterns within the history of professional wrestling that seem to repeat themselves, and we're just trying to give context to what's happening today by looking at the past. And speaking of looking at the past, we might as well start from the beginning.
Oh, you mean the 1800s?
Yes, sir. I do.
All right.
Sick transition, bro. Yeah, dude.
So, we are in the 1800s right now. You know, the Civil War has just ended.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the 1800s? Yeah, that is the
1800s. Yeah, that's the 1800s, dog.
Man, I'm old.
Yeah.
I've been around since the 1800s.
Shut up.
Wrestling was a form of entertainment.
No way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was.
No way.
It was a form of entertainment. Did you believe that? A lot of times it could be found at the carnivals and as traveling acts.
Right.
Most of the wrestlers were actually all college students trying to just make a couple bucks here and there. Like, challenge me, you know, if you can beat me. I'll give you this much, but if I beat you, I take the money.
So it was basically a hustle for people that were like strong men and legit shoot fighters.
Yeah.
In order to hustle villages out of their own money.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Makes sense.
So around the turn of the century, professional wrestling.
Professional wrestling.
Professional wrestling. was just as popular as baseball and boxing, which is huge because, you know, baseball is America's sport.
Yeah, it's America's pastime.
Yeah, that's the word, pastime, not sport. Who cares about
that
word? Who cares
about sports?
This is somewhere around, you know, it's going to be very vast, probably not the right word, but that's okay. Between 1899 and 1913, there's going to be two gentlemen that are the biggest draws around that time.
And what we mean by that in terms of draws, so you're going to hear that a lot going throughout the series. What we mean by draws is people that are legitimately able to draw money from selling more tickets. So anybody that's a draw is usually your top guy. Anybody that is a heel is usually a bad guy. And anybody that is a baby face is usually a good guy. So with all that context, those are pretty similar ground rules to almost everything that we're going to be talking about going forward. We will remind you about this going forward as well. But there were two guys that were main draws.
Yeah, they were the... So during 1899-1913, you had two guys that were your top guys.
Mm-hmm.
By the names of Frank Gotch and Martin Burns.
Okay.
So around... Towards the end of their reign at the top... It's, about we'll say 1913 because that's the date I gave.
Okay.
people started to find out that wrestling was a fix.
Right. And this actually started happening. I don't know if you found this out in your notes, but from my own research, that started coming out because wrestling was starting to eat away at the popularity of boxing. And the reason why this was such a big deal was because wrestling started involving more drama. It evolved from the carnival style wrestling where they're starting to hustle people for their money to now it's like, oh, wrestlers are going against other wrestlers. There's a predetermined outcome. And these two wrestlers are just going to get there through either a series of grappling or telling a story of physical violence. Boxing wanted to get away from that because they saw that they were losing people at their gate in terms of the tickets that they were selling. And so they started doing this behind the curtain kind of esque dirt sheet revealing that, hey, this is all fake. This is all predetermined. They know who's going to win going in. They're working you for your money.
So this is around when Gotch retired is when the crowd started finding out about it was a fix. They were getting more popular. Mm-hmm. You know, Gotch is at that age where he's like, you know what? My body can't do this anymore. So wrestling hit a swift decline. There was no big public name.
There wasn't one promotion that held a lot of weight in that day. It was more so regional. Yeah, it started becoming more branched off.
It was all regional, and there was no big name. Like, you know, you think of our wrestling right now, I'm sure everybody thinks of The Rock and Stone Cold.
Because, Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, they think of those names. So there was no quote-unquote Hulk Hogan.
There was no anymore. Headline. There was no draw to professional wrestling anymore.
So this was a problem till about 1920.
Okay.
And then three gentlemen came along.
And that's what? Toots Mott.
The Gold Billy Dust Sound Trio though. Is what they were called.
Gotcha.
And that consisted of Ed Lewis.
Yep.
Billy Sandow.
Mm-hmm.
And Toots Mott.
Is that how you pronounce it?
I don't know.
Toots or Tots? Toots. I've been saying
Toots Magoot.
Toots Magoot.
So Toots Mott Daunt, however you spell it. If you're listening, Toots, I'm sorry. I'm
pretty sure he's dead.
You don't say that.
He's dead.
No, I don't think they are. So they were known as the Gold Dust Trio.
Okay.
They would go on to shape professional wrestling how we know it today.
Now, what do you mean by that?
They would introduce time limits, disqualifications. They also introduced tag team wrestling.
Gotcha.
And they started to pretty much develop the heel character also.
And how?
When I say that, I mean as in the cheating tactics.
Got it. So like somebody would come out with a manager and that person would get involved, or somebody would poke somebody's eye. Somebody would roll up and get the tights.
Yeah, even though wrestling was predetermined, they made it a show.
Mm-hmm.
So the ref is paying attention to the manager while the wrestler with the manager is poking the eye or something, you know, something illegal.
Right. Makes sense. It started shaping the product that we're currently looking at today.
Yeah, and this is the big one. They also brought in signature moves.
Oh, so like finishers?
Yeah.
Wow.
So this is all around about 1920 to 1922-ish.
Okay.
Say ish.
Mm-hmm. Is that what you say? Is that like the time period that you determined?
That or? I found.
Okay. Just so, making.
I couldn't find an exact date. I'm sure it's out there. I'm really sure it's out there. I just couldn't pin down an exact date. I just kind of found a guesstimation.
All right. We're rolling with it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm no historian or anything.
But I'm just playing one.
Yeah. I didn't even go to college for this. So this was also the start of the very first promotion.
Okay. And that was what? Did you get that?
I actually didn't get the name.
No worries.
I probably should have. Oh, shit.
We're rolling with it.
Yeah, I'm just.
You're not a.
You know what? It's the Gold Dust Trio promotion. How about that?
Got it. Was it with the three of them?
It was with the three of them.
All right, cool. So we're going to call it the Gold Dust Trio.
So within a year, they pretty much took complete control over the professional wrestling industry.
Gotcha.
They figured by keeping the same stable of wrestlers, it would keep the fans familiar with those people,
mm-hmm.
where they would come back more and more and more. It would also help them build that fan base, wherever they went by advertising the same wrestlers.
Right. So you would start developing characters based around these people that you were advertising, because the more that you see them, the more that you want to actually interact with them, the more that you're creating the stars that you see.
Yeah. And I know, off topic real quick, so they pretty much were always working the gimmick.
Got it.
I think. I mean, I know that in the 80s, they were always, that was them.
Well, they were protecting the business because,
yeah.
Because especially if you think about it in context to where they're coming from, this trio revitalized professional wrestling. Point blank, yeah, no discussion.
I'll say this also. I think it's around Iowa, like the Midwest is where it was happening.
Okay.
So
I'm pretty sure, so I'm not trying to dismiss you or make
no,
this.
No.
So I think that
correct
it
me if I'm wrong.
I'm pretty sure that this started happening around New York, because I think that, especially with the research that we're doing for the next episode, is going to be where Jess McMahon, who was a former boxing promoter, and also the first generation of McMahons that got into professional wrestling, he started promoting the Gold Dust Trio, I'm pretty sure. But we can get that on another date, to be quite frank with you, man.
Oh, yeah. I know that... Oh, excuse me. I know that the Gold Dust Trio were from the Midwest. So that's why, right, I'm guessing that it's the Midwest.
Makes sense. And a lot of what we're going to be going over in the next, decades is going to be centered around the Midwest and then going into the South. So it just makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
So, when these guys started the promotion with all the stuff that they've included and introduced, one of the big ones, it's probably my favorite, is the feuds and storylines they started creating.
Okay.
They would go on to call it long-term booking.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Why does that sound so familiar, Steve?
Because I'm pretty sure AEW does it.
And New Japan does it as well.
That's right. I don't get the chance to watch much New Japan. Yeah, it's real hard.
I know. I just have been watching so much All Japan professional wrestling and older Japanese professional wrestling, to where you get to see the investment in the fans, because you can see how much, especially in the early 2000s and even the late 90s, how big professional wrestling used to be in Japan, where people used to be these fucking rock stars and they'd have this aura about them. And in Japan, it's a little bit different, where they actually still treat it like a sport. And these guys just absolutely hit the crap out of each other, man. It's unbelievable.
So on the subject of New Japan for a second.
Uh-huh.
I think Friday, there is a New Japan on Fight TV at 10 p.m. It's Jon Moxley in a triple threat match. It might be a Fatal 4.
Okay.
But he's also defending the U.S. title May 12th. I can't remember where I found it. But just throwing that out there, because you know how my brain works.
I know.
I have to get it out there.
I know, or it's going to eat you alive.
It will, and it's so weird.
So continue. Where are we at here?
So they would stay on. They would stay on top of the wrestling business for almost a decade.
Right, and this is through long-term storytelling, building these stars, having this faction, having the stable of wrestlers that they're able to promote and go from territory to territory, basically promoting their own stars.
Yeah, which is, man, to be alive during that time, I bet you it was crazy. I think professional wrestling now is an insane time to be alive, because no, all these cross promotions. But could you imagine that era?
I would have loved to have been a professional wrestling fan in an era where nobody knew what was going on. I would have absolutely loved that, because I remember when I was a kid and I thought I was real, and I thought,
I thought it was real.
I wanted it to be so bad. And I shooed away so many people when I was a kid, when they would come up and be like, it's fake, right? Like, shut up. My dad can beat your dad up.
Yeah, my response to those people were, suck it.
Yeah? Would you give him the chop?
I gave him the chop. But I wasn't always this size, so I would run.
I cried a lot.
I didn't cry. I
cried a lot. Yeah. I cried a lot, and then I tried to beat people up, and that didn't go very well. So they would go from territory to territory, promotion to promotion, and they would be basically promoting themselves. They were on top
for over almost a decade.
Got it.
So do you know what happens when things become popular?
People want to get involved with it. People want to replicate it, right?
Exactly. Hmm. So local promotions started popping up all around the country.
Right.
This is around the late 20s, early 30s. A man, and I'm going to butcher his name, Stanislaus. Stan is Laus. Just pronouncing letters. Zabisco.
Of the famous Zabisco family.
Yes.
Yep.
Was supposed to drop the title to a new and upcoming wrestler named Wayne Munn.
Okay.
Zabisco.
And this is around what time?
Oh, this is around that time, the late 20s, early 30s.
Got it. Okay.
Zabisco wasn't having it. He was not going to drop a title to some punk.
Right.
Some little punk.
In his territory.
In his territory, coming over trying to steal his girl. not in my house. So he went against the booking and pinned Munn and won and retained the belt.
You're going to see a theme here starting now is that usually, especially around like the 1940s going into the 1960s, when the NWA actually gets formed, that they actually book as their champion. And I'll get into the reason why later. But a lot of territories would book legit tough shoot fighters as their champion for this exact reason. So if somebody actually ended up going against the booking, they could legit wrestle them into submission, or in certain cases would like bite them or like do something that was just,
oh, the old bite. I was trying to think of
something. You're trying to be clever right there.
Yeah, I just
didn't work.
Just the bite. The old teeth knuckle shuffle.
Teeth knuckle shuffle. I think that we came up with your signature move.
All right.
Yeah.
But where I'm going to put my teeth
is on your teeth.
Sure.
All right. So,
out of spite, this man, old Zabisco, he went on to drop the title, but it wasn't to Wayne Munn. It was actually Ed Lewis, one of the Gold Dust Trio founders.
And he was in a different promotion, correct?
Who, Ed Lewis?
Yeah.
He was, so Zabisco was Ed Lewis's champion.
Okay.
He went on to drop the title to Ed Lewis's competition.
Oh.
Old Joe Stretcher.
Okay. Wait a minute. Ed the Strangler Lewis's competition was a dude named Joe Stretcher.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
You can't make that stuff up.
Stretcher would then go on and make it even worse by avoiding Ed Lewis. Ed Lewis is here like, all right, man, you got the belt. Can I have it back now?
Right.
Joe Stretcher's nuts like, nah, player, I ain't giving that shit back. Or he just wouldn't answer his telegraphs.
You know, or smoke signals.
Early 30s. Telegraphs are a thing, right?
I think it's a telegram?
Oh, yeah. Telegram. I'm dumb. Don't judge me. Telegram. What's a telegraph? What's the difference between a telegram and a telegraph? Go ahead and hit us up on the email.
at
WrestleologyPodcast@gmail.com.
Wow.
Go ahead and tell me.
All right. Well, we're going to save that for the email.
Hopefully I get somebody to email me. That'd be cool. I want to read an email.
I mean, you don't already.
I do too read emails.
Are you sure?
I started to.
Oh.
I downloaded the email app.
The email app.
Well, the Gmail app. I downloaded it. I never had it before.
You never had it before?
Nah.
Oh, man. You should have kept that off your phone.
Well, I started ordering things. Like, I just ordered a new pair of work shoes, a new work apron. and some cool shorts that have 7-inch inseam, which I'm super stoked about that.
Wow, you're going to show them knees, boy.
I'll be trying to show my knees. Dang. All right, back to what we were talking about.
Yes, sir.
Where was I? Oh, Joe Stretcher
would
avoiding...
not drop the title back to Ed Lewis.
He wouldn't give the title back to Ed Lewis. So by this time, the Goldust Trio promotion, as what I was calling it, they finally got the belt back. This is probably mid-30s, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get a date. I'm sure there is one. I'm just terrible at internet. They got the belt back. By this time, but it was so long that the promotion didn't have the belt that it was pretty much worthless.
Right.
The fans were like...
delegitimized it.
Yeah. They're like, oh, they just let some random guy take their belt and not get it back. So it pretty much killed
the entire promotion.
It killed
their
entire promotion.
That's crazy, man. The fact that one move to where you took somebody else's title completely delegitimized it because they couldn't have it to defend.
Yeah, so it made them look like their guys are weak.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, at the end of the day, like, if you have nothing to defend, you're not really a champion, right?
Yeah, you're just a soft-ass bitch.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, we're in probably the late 30s, early 40s around this time.
Okay.
So, the whole landscape of professional wrestling is just completely different than from what we were discussing earlier. There's no more wrestling at carnivals and farms. Like, they've moved on.
Okay.
They're actually in, like... arenas or some kind of...
They're like in civic centers or county centers or something like that. They're actually in like an auditorium.
So this isn't the exact name of it, but I liked the name when I was doing my research.
Mm-hmm.
We're entering the raiding talent era.
Okay. And I'm assuming that's because people started stealing talent from other promotions.
That's exactly what happened. And so all these other promotions, they would purposely sabotage or raid nearby promotions for their talent.
Huh. That sounds familiar.
We've been doing that ever since then.
Oddly familiar.
Yeah. So this, of course, would lead to a lot of bitter fights between, you know, the two promoters that are either raiding or being raided.
Uh-huh.
Which in turn, of course, making titles lose the credibility.
So everybody's just going around screwing everybody, essentially.
Yeah, they're trying to ruin the business. They're trying to put themselves on top. Trying to make as much money as they possibly can.
But all at the expense of the professional wrestling business.
Yeah. And the... other wrestlers.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, like, they don't care about those other guys. I'm sure they might, but...
It was a different time, though, because you're talking about, like... Oh, that's going to sound really good in the podcast, me eating a piece of ice.
Oh, yeah, that's
Oh,
sexy.
Man, player. That really felt good on my teeth. But, no, I mean, it makes sense, because at the time, you're coming out of, what, the Great Depression? And... people really aren't as unified or as caring as today because, one, technology's not where it was. Two, education's not where it was. And three, the amount of money that you could make in a short amount of time doing professional wrestling, people are more so focused upon their survival and getting as much money in a very short amount of time as possible. So I totally understand where it comes from, but it sucks because it came to lead to the degradation, or that's probably the wrong word, we're both fucking morons, to the deterioration of the professional wrestling business at such a young age, you know?
Yeah, so you're like you were saying, we coming out of the Great Depression that ended around 1933,
mm-hmm.
We're in the late 30s, early 40s, so they're in a Great Recession.
Right.
In 37, 38.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I know my history.
Wow.
What's up?
Dude, you looked that up on Wikipedia.
Wickle what? What is that?
So they were coming out of a Great Recession. We're now in the 30s, early 40s,
well,
right?
we're now fast forwarding almost 10 years.
Wow. Light speed.
Can you guess what?
Where we're at?
Where we're at?
Are we in Waterloo, Iowa?
We are, because they were like, we have to do something about...
Who was we? All these different promoters and
stuff
like
that? Yeah, sorry. So all the promoters are like, we have to do something about the way we're treating each other. Like, this is bullshit. None of us are making money.
Right. So they did what? It was what? Originally five promoters, right? Five promoters
that wanted to unify. I'm going to say that. It's probably the worst word ever for it.
I mean, it is the right word.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Well, I got a word right. They wanted to unify the wrestling promotion with the NWA. And on that note, I'm going to pass it off to Luke. That was my Ultimate Warrior impression.
You're going to tell me that I'm going to crash in a plane later or something like that?
Well, no, that would be me. Ultimate Warrior. What?
Yeah, dude. You didn't know about that promo?
The only promos I ever remember about Ultimate Warrior, he talked about lightning striking his enemies and crashing down. Oh, crashing down.
Yeah, dog.
There it is.
did you like put it together at that point? Yeah. He was talking about Hulk Hogan in a plane, dog.
Dude, he was an angry man who did a lot of cocaine.
Coked up angry man that was on a lot of testosterone and anabolic steroids. So I'm going to pick up where Steve left off, and I'm going to make a little bit of correction. So in July of 1948 in Waterloo, Iowa, originally with the backing of five promoters, Paul Pinky George founded the NWA. And like Steve had mentioned and was correct about, but just want to rephrase it into my own vernacular, is that...
Oh, you think you're so fucking smart.
Yeah, I do. I went to fucking college, bro. That was aggressive. I'm sorry.
Yeah, man.
I'm sorry, man. Originally, with the backing of five different promoters, Paul Pinky George founded the NWA as a way of maximizing the trading of stars in between promotions and other territories specific to their geographic location. So everything that Steve had just said, that's basically the reason why. They wanted to legitimize wrestling again, and the only way to do that is by bringing everybody together and realizing that they needed one world's heavyweight champion. The first NWA heavyweight champion was one of the five original promoters. His name was Orvel Brown, and he was one of the original board members of the NWA, board of directors.
Did you know Orvel Brown's finisher move was called the old Brown Eye?
I did not.
I made that up.
Yeah? Did he bump people with his butt?
Yeah, he did the butt push.
He did the butt push?
Yeah.
I do a butt push every morning and every night.
Oh.
Sorry. All right. I put...
Was that a poop joke?
Yeah, it was a poop joke, but it sounded a little bit sexual.
Way worse.
Anyways.
Yeah, back to that. I just wanted to throw a joke in there.
Yeah, and then I made it a lot worse. And we thought that the thing about women's wrestling was bad.
It's fine. You're perfectly fine.
So we're going to be fast forwarding into the 1950s. So now with the crowning of Brown as the first world's heavyweight champion, the NWA was set to recognize that championship across all the territories as the actual world's heavyweight championship.
So what you're saying is all these territories, all these other promotions, so they would have their own champion, but under one banner, they would have just one world champion?
So, yeah. So, let me explain that a little bit. So, their strategy with this was to have one world champion go across every single territory, like you were just saying.
Yeah.
To go throughout North America. And then later, and we'll get to that, is to go overseas to, like, Japan and Europe to help grow the market. They would go to these different regions, and they would go and wrestle the regional champion. So, for example, let's say that Psycho Steve Fury was the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion, and I was the Florida Heavyweight Champion. Steve would come to my territory, they would build up the promotion for that fight, and Steve and I would wrestle. Most of the time with that, so that we would keep legitimacy between both Steve and I, and also want a crowd to come back to see a rematch. there would either be a screwy finish or some sort of way. The old
screwy finish.
The old
man.
Screwy finish. Somebody would either be, unless I was a heel and they were trying to get me out and they were trying to not push me anymore, there would be something that would go wrong that would leave doubt in people's minds that me, as the Florida heavyweight champion, would be able to beat Steve if I had another match.
You would never beat me.
I mean, you have what, the teeth knuckle shuffle? Is that your finishing move? I got the old brown eye, bro.
I will tongue dart that brown eye move. Yeah, this just went real soft.
Yeah. Wow. I'm proud of you for that one. So, with Brown crowned as the first heavyweight champion
of the Super Bowl.
Of the world. With that, there was their first major conflict, which leads us to Luthez, who created the Luthez Press and is also a wrestling legend in his own right. Page one down. He was actually running a promotion in St. Louis that was rivaling one of the other NWA board of directors members, which is a name that's going to come back very recently, like within the next couple of pages that we go through, Sam Muchnick and his promotion in St. Louis, and who was also promoting Brown as the NWA heavyweight champion. The two promotions between Luthez's promotion as well as Sam Muchnick's promotion brokered a deal to unify the promotions and the champion, the championships in a winner-take-all match to determine who would be the unified NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. Unfortunately, my voice got real high for that one. Unfortunately.
Hey, old Brady Bunch episode over here.
I'm going through puberty, everybody. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you're having to see these growing pains on the air. But unfortunately, the match never happened. And the reason why is because weeks before the contest, Brown actually got into a car accident that ended up ending his career. And because of that, the NWA eventually ended up awarding Luthez as the NWA's World Heavyweight Champion. Now, this is going into the 50s. We're at around 1949, where we're going into the 1950s. And because of this, Luthez was starting to be booked as a legit world's champion. Luthez was a legit fighter. And the reason why they backed him so much in the NWA was because of what we were saying earlier, is if somebody did not want to go with the booking of the promotion, Luthez would make sure that that booking and that decision over his dead body would go through.
I know there's pictures of Luthez, but I don't want to look at him. Because I just want to picture him as a big, beefy, bald-headed man.
That's not him at all.
I know, but
he looks more like me without this terrible mustache.
I want to see him with a bald head, because that's how I picture him in my head.
It's not him. Do you want to look him up really quick?
It's going to ruin the image of him in my head. You know what's funny is I probably have seen him before.
Not every top guy can look like Stone Cold Steve Austin, okay?
I have a bald head, and I just want him to match me. Okay. Oh, he is a hairy, hairy man.
Yeah.
Good for him.
I know.
Good for him.
Yep. Unlike you, you're balding.
Whoa, man. I have as much chest hair as him, though.
Yeah, you have a sweater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's cool.
No problem, player. Back on subject?
Yes.
All right, cool. So, going into the 1950s, in a weird strain and turn of events, becoming the full-time booker for Thez, who used to be his rival promoter in another promotion, Sam Muchnick became the president and full-time booker of the NWA. With this change in leadership, Muchnick and Thez would go in to usher a new age into professional wrestling, going around from promotion to promotion, unifying those world heavyweight championships.
So pretty much just when you say unify, you mean getting rid of all the other championships and be like, no, this one's real.
Yep.
You guys are fake champions.
So it wasn't that. So what happened was that the NWA, and we're going to actually get into that pretty soon, probably next, is that the NWA had a membership fee, and they had different people that were in the NWA that would pay the membership fee so that they could have preferred booking and have the NWA champion come to their town. All of those promotions had a different world champion. Like California had the California world champion. We're going to see it in a couple.
Oh, beat Nick.
100%. And we're going to go over it in the next couple of segments is that even Nebraska with Vern Gagne, he became the world heavyweight champion of Omaha, which doesn't make sense. But he beat somebody else for the NWA championship who claimed that he beat Luthez. We're going to get to this in the future. He claimed that he beat Luthez due to a screwy finish. And then...
Oh, you know what? I actually remember reading about that finish.
Yep.
Yeah.
But let's get back on track. Now we're in around the mid-50s, and now with the success of Thez and membership to the NWA becoming more and more exclusive for both promoters and wrestlers alike. So
if you wanted to get into the NWA, it's not like you're just, I'm going to start a wrestling promotion. Okay, NWA, you can bring your champion. You had to
pay a membership fee to be on.
Oh, yeah, I actually didn't know that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. So all the major wrestling promotions were a part of this. However, they
were very...
Are you scratching your nuts right now?
Dude. It's not my nuts. It's actually my top of my thigh.
You like went straight in.
You ever get that... Fuck, I'm trying to describe the itch. It's like...
Where it's like underneath your thigh. Like,
yeah, it's like sharp. Right. And you're like, I have to get it.
Yep.
Sorry, man.
No, it's all good, man.
It wasn't my nut, though.
Wasn't your nut?
No.
Not one of them.
No. It was right up in here, like the top of my thigh. For anybody that obviously can't see, I'm literally trying to show Luke where I was scratching.
All right. So... So... Now the fact that, you know, wrestling has become more exclusive, promoters and wrestlers alike.
You all right, man?
I am fine.
I've never seen a man scratch his thigh before. Dang.
Oh, it's hot in here? I think it's hot in here.
I do have a good looking thigh.
You do. You're a beautiful man, Steve.
I try. My wife has made me very pretty recently.
Yeah? Did she start lotioning your beard or something?
No. She's been making me diet and... Eat better.
Gotcha. And what do you mean by eat better? Has she made you beets?
Well, only when... I say eat better. Only when...
Not the Wendy's biggie bag.
Because when she's not around, I'm eating absolute trash.
Yep. That's probably our favorite thing to do is just eat KFC and go watch professional wrestling.
So good. What did I eat recently that was very disgusting that I was very disappointed in myself? I can't remember, but I know I'm going to remember in like 10 minutes and probably interrupt it out. And blurt it out.
So with wrestling becoming more exclusive for both the promoters that are trying to get into the NWA and then wrestlers that want to be booked with the NWA, an association of bookers and professional wrestlers So with all of that being said, with the NWA becoming more exclusive, and completely cutting out my fuck up that I just had, the NWA became under fire from the federal government for violating the Sherman Antitrust Act because they became a monopoly.
Sounds very government-y.
Yep. But at the same time, I mean, there is a point to be made here.
Four gas station hot dogs. I remember now. And a bag of these new chips called... mustard.
Is that the stuff that you sent me for a photo? No, it was
no,
the corn
No, those
are ones.
Really good, though. Dude. The sweet corn street or whatever.
You're a man child.
Yeah, they're really good. But Ruffles makes a honey mustard chip now. That's delicious.
Yeah?
Yeah. Okay. Sorry for interrupting.
No.
But it was four hot dogs from the gas station.
Which gas station was it? Was it
7-Eleven?
Oh, at least
it's right by my house.
7-Eleven hot dogs are
good.
But
they don't have those cool pop vinyls. or the pop figures.
Not on the south side.
Whoa, dude.
Bro, I'm not wrong. Dude. Player, I'm not wrong.
Remind me to tell you something later about the CVS by my house.
Okay, I'm going to cut that out of the episode.
Banana hat.
Cool. So, to read directly what it says in the junction, basically the suit against the NWA by the United States government. Combinations and conspiracies, monopolies, consent, decree, practices enjoyed, trade association exclusion from trade bookers and promoters of professional wrestling, an association of bookers and promoters of the professional wrestlers, and consenting members of the association were prohibited by a consent decree from entering into any understanding having the purpose or effect of recognizing any booker or promoter as the exclusive booker or promoter in a designated territory, preventing any booker or promoter from doing business in any territory, restricting the promoter or booker from wrestling exhibitions to relating promotions or to promoters or bookers who are members of the association, requiring any booker to book wrestling exhibitions through only promoter members, or discriminating in a favor of promoter bookers, blah, 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 blah.
So basically, pretty much what it's saying is the government's like, fuck you.
Yeah. So I'm going to dive a little bit deeper into that.
But that's very law-y.
That's very law-y. And it's also written as the longest run-on sentence that I've ever copied and pasted from Wikipedia.
Jesus.
Did you notice one period in that?
Actually, I just saw one.
Yeah. And it's all the way down in the middle of the paragraph.
Is that the only one?
That's the only one, bro. I was having trouble with my breath at that point.
Even at the end of the paragraph, there's not one. Period.
That's on me though.
Oh. I thought it was on Wikipedia.
So basically what was happening was the NWA was basically telling people within the association what they could and could not do, who they could promote with and who they couldn't, and they were telling basically people outside the promotion that they couldn't use people inside the promotion if they were not a part of the NWA. Now, in addition to this, along with the U.S. government cracking down on them, they also started to see their first defections from the organization due to conflicts in the booking decisions. One of these first breaks within the organization happened a year after this suit was filed, when Montreal promoter Ed Quinn walked out of an August NWA meeting in St. Louis. Quinn had fallen out with Sam Muchnick over a number of issues. Quinn
was money.
It's probably money. Well, I mean, and also at the same time, he was probably running. Well, I mean, he was helping run a St. Louis promotion with Muchnick, and he wasn't really happy with the way that things were being booked and how the organization was being run, quite frankly, probably because he had somebody that he had in mind to be a champion, and also for what they have here is that he was angry with Muchnick about dealings that he had with a rogue promoter and Quinn's rival, Jack Pfeiffer, right? So petty bullshit, which is
like a bunch of little high school girls or boys.
Yeah.
Always trying to start some shit.
Always trying to start some shit. But this seems to be the nature of professional wrestling, that it's always this like telenovela type style drama, right? Where it's like, oh, you can't do this because I'm doing it. Oh, well, what are you going to do?
Oh. Why can't they just be grown men about their business?
Because that's not fun. It's not fun and watchable. Come on, dude. You know
I would
that.
I would watch a whole TV show about me being a grown man doing my business.
I know, but here's the thing, is that you're not going to watch a professional wrestling program about that.
I also am really vain when it comes to myself. I'd watch myself on TV all day.
I can see that.
I'd be like, dang, look at that dude's butt. It's so good.
So, at this time that Quinn walked out, a wrestler by the name of Edouard Carpenter was involved in an angle where he and Lewis both were being presented around the NWA as champion. This was actually that angle that I was telling you about earlier.
Yeah.
Where they had the dispute. This occurred after Carpenter had a dispute with a win over Thez on June 14th, 1957. And some of the promoters in the NWA considered it a legitimate title change. Now, I'm going to give a little bit more context to this, is that during the time that the internet wasn't around,
You mean the internet wasn't around in 1957? I know, player.
I know that there was one time where you thought...
How did they live?
I know that you thought that the internet was alive like way before the 90s, but...
I legitimately thought YouTube was around in the 90s.
That was great. That was probably my favorite moment that we've had so far.
I feel like it's really hard to think that 1990 was over 30 years ago.
Almost 30 years ago. No, it is over. It is. Yeah. It's 31 years ago. Fuck, bro. That makes me feel old.
Man.
Oh, dude, I'm coming up on 30. I do not.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, I know. I know that you're almost 40.
I am closer to 40 than 30.
Yes, you are.
It's fine, man.
You're welcome. No problem.
It's fine. I was still pooping my pants in the 90s. Not really. It just sounded good.
Hey, if pooping pants makes you cool, you can call me Miles Davis.
It was peeing your pants makes
you
cool. I know,
but... Glad that you know that.
I've watched that movie more times than I could probably count, and I'm not proud of it. There's a lot of movies that I have watched more times than I can count. One of them being Mean Girls also.
Mean Girls?
Oh, my God.
That's a good movie to watch a million times, bro.
Want to have a Mean Girls party later?
Yeah, we can do that.
Tight. I love that movie.
Yeah, man. That's a good movie. So to give context behind... Before the internet with wrestling. So you would go, the champion would go from territory to territory. Now, if somebody was protected, like a regional champion was protected, and he was a huge star, usually what you would do is during those circumstances, the champion would actually in that territory lose to the local champion. Now, with that, usually it was followed up by an immediate rematch where the champion of the local territory would then lose to the world's heavyweight champion. And this was done to, one, build new stars, and two, to legitimize the world's championship in a different way. There would still be one world's champion that would go from territory to territory, but it would make it so that there were credible challengers that gave the championship a reason for us to actually watch. It would give people a reason to draw, and also it would create a conflict in what was actually happening. So, going back to the original idea for this dispute, the original idea was to build to a dispute of the title into a high-profile rematch. When Quinn left the NWA, Muchnick announced that Carpenter had never been officially the champion and had no claim to the championship.
Dang.
I know, player.
Did him wrong.
I know. It's crazy. So afterwards, Quinn saw the financial possibilities in Carpenter's situation and began to negotiate with other NWA member promotions and continued to recognize Carpenter as the champion. He offered to have Carpenter lose a title match to their prospective champions, thus giving them a legitimate claim on the NWA title if they decided to break from the NWA.
So after they claimed that Carpenter wasn't the official champion,
they started just pimping him out.
But that's weird. They told me, so he stayed with the promotion still?
So he didn't stay with the promotion, but he had a championship. He had the NWA championship. The angle was that you had these two champions.
Yeah.
One in a weird, screwy way, and then the other one is this remarkable hero who at this point has almost been heavyweight champion for 10 years.
That's insane.
I know.
And I always forget about that. Like during that time, we didn't have a 6-month champion or a 4-month champion. These champions, they held them belts.
Lou Thez held championships for years. I mean, he lost to a couple of people for like 6 months at a time so that he could give himself time to recover from like a surgery or just get some downtime so that he could recover from being on the road because it was a hard life, man, especially with
especially in the 50s.
Oh my gosh. Traveling anywhere in the 50s must have been difficult. The fact that you didn't have technology at your fingertips, the fact that you're probably driving in these small cars with not very good cushioning, the shoes that you were wearing were probably not very supportive, the fact that you're actually wrestling on wood pallets that are not protected, the fact that it's probably steel beams.
It was probably the exact way a boxing ring was
made.
Yeah,
it's probably exactly the right way to put it. And the fact that these guys are legitimate tough guys, and they've probably been wrestling their entire lives, or they lived a hard life because it was the fucking 50s.
My back is hurting just thinking about it.
I can imagine, man. I mean, yeah, that's the best way to put it. But anyways, getting back to this, while some took up Quinn's offer and title switches took place in those territories, none would match the impact of the title change in Nebraska. Omaha, Nebraska.
Of all places.
I know. And Vern Gagne became the world champion when he defeated Carpenter in Omaha on August 9th in 1958 for what would become the World Heavyweight Championship of Omaha, like I said earlier.
Oh, so they didn't make him the NWA champion.
No, he became his own champion of his own promotion, which we're going to get to in a minute. But in the same year, Fez became the first wrestler to defend his NWA World Heavyweight Championship in Japan. Either 57 or 58, he became the first wrestler to defend his NWA Heavyweight Championship.
Like first American wrestler.
Yes.
That's...
He was the first one to make a trip over to Japan into the Orient.
Say like the early 60s?
No.
Late 50s still?
Late 50s still.
That's crazy.
Late 50s. And this is what started to popularize wrestling in Japan. He started having these series of 60-minute draws.
We see that today.
I know.
Well, not draws, but...
No, but this was like legit shoot fighting. Like, because you know the Japanese style.
Yeah.
Where it's like over there, they've never seen this. He had a series of wrestling matches with this guy named Ricky Dozan, where they went 60 minutes.
I was wondering
minutes.
How you pronounce that name.
I'm just going off.
I was going with Ricky Dozan.
Ricky Dozan!
That sounds about right.
That sounds about right. So because of these bouts, wrestling started to gain a mainstream popularity and acceptance in Japan. Which is crazy to me because it's just this
Western culture.
Especially back then.
Yeah.
Especially like right after the World War. You're going to tell me an American is going to go into Japan
and change something about their
culture?
Yeah, that's...
That's crazy, bro. So
good for Luthez.
Yeah. And
good for him, man.
And because of this, and because of good for Luthez, he realized that he could make more money in Japan than anywhere else. So Fez started petitioning to the NWA and their promoters to regularly defend the championships that they had in Japan. But his request was turned down. And
really?
Yeah, it was turned down because they didn't realize, because what gain would those promoters have? They didn't see it in the same like macro view.
Yeah,
right?
I guess there's not cable television.
No.
So,
well, and this is this part of it. So going from the 50s into the 60s is when syndicated television started happening. So that's when everything started becoming more globalized.
I don't think globalized syndication television was a thing. Like, it'd be good if they had an NWA show in Japan.
Right.
But I'm pretty sure that wasn't even in their radar.
No, but here's what happened is that they would try to go over to Japan. It didn't work out. The requests were denied, right? But it was mostly because people wanted to make money in the States, because you can't, especially back then, people have never been to Japan. They've only read about it in books or in shows. We just went to war with this country.
Yeah.
So why the hell would this carnival culture, which is as American as apple pie, why would they want to go into the Orient to make money when they can make as much money here in the United States, especially in a period of time where wrestling was thriving? Why would you take such a risk to do something that didn't make sense to them logically? So with that, after they turned down his request, Fez then ended up dropping the title to his own handpicked champion, Dick Hutton. And rather than him dropping the championship to Buddy Rogers, who is going to come up in another episode, which will be the next episode for the WWE, WWF, and WWWF, because Buddy Rogers eventually went on to become the WWWF's first world heavyweight champion.
WWF.
Yeah. WWF. Yeah. So with this, Fez would embark on a tour of Europe and Japan, billing himself as a new champion, the NWA International Heavyweight Champion.
Did he actually have a title, or did he just make it up?
He made a new one up.
My man.
I know.
Making shit up.
What a player.
I'm going to go around making up a title. I am Steve Fury, the junk food eating champion.
I'm going to say that I'm the wrestling podcast world heavyweight champion.
See, I didn't want to go that route.
I did.
Man, that's a tall order.
Player.
I did. You're going to have to fight the likes of like Jericho and Stone Cold.
I'm spry and I'm young.
And then if you throw in podcast, you're going to have to fight all those MMA dudes. I'm going to pass.
I don't care.
I'll watch.
Line them up like dominoes. I'm going to knock him down.
You guys hear that?
Knock him down.
He said he's throwing out a challenge.
I'm going to knock you down.
He's throwing out a challenge.
All right. So getting back to the story before I start murdering people. And then as the 1950s started to come to a close, professional wrestling started to lose its high ratings, and producers realizing that they had overexposed the business soon dropped wrestling shows from their lineups. And that is it for this podcast. We actually decided to break this podcast up into two episodes because by the time that we had ended recording, it had ended up being around 2 hours. And personally, I know for me and from what other people have said and from the criticisms that we've gotten from other people when making podcasts, is that you want to give people stuff that's in bite sizes of no more than like 45 minutes to an hour. So we're giving this podcast into two parts. Thank you guys for listening. And if you like this podcast, feel free to like, share, and subscribe. And please follow us on social media platforms. Steve, do you want to take it from here where they can find us?
They can email us at WrestleologyPodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at Wrestleology Podcast. Twitter at _Wrestleology. And I remembered the wrestler we were talking about, Nick Abrams.
Okay, so just a heads up, this was recorded after the outro. Or sorry, this is the outro that was recorded after the intro for the second part of this episode. So there is a story that goes along with that name of a guy that has soaking wet hair, and he decided to touch Steve with his tattoos.
Listen to the next episode,
and you'll find out. Thank you guys for listening. My name's Luke Bad News Burton.
I'm Psycho Steve Fury,
and this is Wrestleology.
Booyah!